This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Some of Vermont's lawmakers and elected officials have been taking steps to limit the reach of the federal government. Alarmed by the executive order signed by President Trump in the first few weeks of his administration, a tripartisan group got together to write up a bill that would prevent Vermont law enforcement officers from cooperating with the federal government on certain orders. Here now to catch us up to speed on how things are moving in Montpelier is Vermont Press Bureau Chief Neil Goswami. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Jane.
This was one of those occasions that was sort of built for a photo op, it seems. You know, when a whole bunch of high-powered politicians of different persuasions come together, they have a press conference, they put their support behind this legislation. Can you describe who's on board?
Yeah, I mean, it really was an extraordinary spectacle. You have the Republican governor, the Democratic attorney general, Republicans, progressives, and Democrats in the legislature, everybody really standing together to make a clear point that they have some grave concerns about these executive orders signed by the president. So really a very unique thing in Vermont and elsewhere to see such support for one idea.
As I said, it was a tripartisan group, but the sort of missing piece here was Minority Leader Don Turner. He was not on board with this, and you know, it was pretty apparent because he wasn't there. What does he have to say?
Well, he was not standing up there with the rest of the crowd, but he did make himself available to reporters after that press conference, and he really said that he was unwilling to sign on to this legislation or this concept until he really knew more about what it would do and what it would say. And he wanted to make clear to Vermonters that not everybody inside the State House was 100% behind this effort. Really, it's, I think, just a little bit of politics at play. We are a fairly Democratic state, but we should also remember that there are a fair number of Republicans and others out there who might see themselves more in line with President Trump than what the governor and the legislature are looking to do here.
And Don Turner did say, look, I'm not saying I'm opposed to this. I'm just not signing on yet.
That is correct. He did say he might end up supporting this in the end.
As I mentioned, the bill is designed to prevent Vermont law enforcement officers from sort of being in cooperation with the federal government on certain immigration policies. But can you go into a little bit more detail about what the bill says?
Yeah, sure. There are really two key components to the legislation. The first one, that, as you mentioned, really prohibits local, state, or county law enforcement agencies from entering into partnerships with the federal government to essentially be deputized as federal immigration enforcement officers. In the legislation, it lays out that only the governor can authorize such agreements. We do have some of those agreements now between the Border Patrol and state police, and some fairly unique things going on at the border between Vermont and Canada. So it essentially says that in the future, only the governor can authorize those.
Why do we need that, though, given that we already have a fair and impartial policing policy on the books that's supposed to be designed so that law enforcement officers aren't asking things like your immigration status if it's not germane to the case?
Well, so the other component, I guess, that I didn't go into was it essentially says that local, state, and county law enforcement officers should not collect personally identifying information, which would be a person's sex, their sexual orientation, their gender, their marital status, race, religion, national origin, or immigration status. We do have this sort of bias-free policing initiative basically on the books right now. But what I think this is trying to head off is any type of registration that the federal government might pursue. You'll recall from the presidential campaign, there was a lot of talk about a possible Muslim registry by the president, now President Trump. And there was some very serious concerns within the State House and within state government that the state should be proactive and try to head off any attempt at that by the federal government.
Neil, do you have a sense, though, if this bill prevents officers from sort of keeping that information on the books, how does that affect the ability of departments to collect race data that they are supposed to be collecting so that you know, we can know things about traffic stops, for example?
There are provisions that that do allow law enforcement to collect information as long as it's not able to be linked back to an individual.
I see.
So if a if under the bias-free policing and other initiatives here in Vermont, law enforcement are collecting data on somebody's race to determine if we are policing in a fair and impartial way. That could continue under language in the legislation.
This bill is being fast-tracked in the State House. So where does it stand now?
The Senate Judiciary Committee actually probably voting either now or very soon on this bill to send it out of committee. And that would mean it would be on the Senate floor as early as Tuesday, very likely Tuesday. It's expected to move quickly through the Senate and onto the House. It's very likely that in a couple of weeks this could be headed to the governor's desk.
So there's no sense that this is not going to pass.
It's very clear. The legislative leaders have made very clear that they want to move this quickly, and with the broad support, it's not expected to see any significant roadblocks.
Has there been testimony? I mean, that's what Don Turner said he wanted to hear, and what's that been like?
Yeah, there has been testimony. There has been some back and forth as they've gone through what they call markup of the bill. The governor's legal counsel, Jay Pershing Johnson, was in there this morning, and she was really pushing back on a provision that said agreements that the governor may authorize should have the advice and consent of the Senate. She and the administration did not like the advice and consent of the Senate part, so that was struck from the language. So there have been people from the administration, the Attorney General's office, and I believe some law enforcement personnel in to share their thoughts and concerns and provide some suggested language changes. So there has been testimony. I'm not sure. I have not spoken with Representative Turner to determine if it's enough for him. I suppose we will find out next week when the bill heads to the House.
And it would go into effect immediately?
It would. The original drafting of the language, it was set for a July 1st effective date. They have since changed that to effective on passage, so it would happen immediately. There was some discussion, and everyone seemed to agree that there was no need to wait to have it go into effect.
When the legislation was announced, Attorney General T.J. Donovan was pretty clear about saying that the bill had been specifically crafted to withstand legal challenge. Is it likely to face one?
I'm not sure at this point. It's hard to say what the Trump administration or other federal agencies and departments might do. I will note, however, that there are a number of the sections in the bill that pertain to federal statute and that seek to sort of defer to federal statute in certain cases. So it does appear as though the administration, the Attorney General's office, and lawmakers have done their homework to try and conform to existing law.
Vermont Press Bureau Chief Neil Goswami. Neil, thanks very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we'll talk with Eric Miller about his decision to leave his position as U.S. Attorney for the District of Vermont with such a pointed public statement of resignation that seemed to point directly at the policies of Donald Trump. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Last Friday was Eric Miller's final day serving as the U.S. Attorney for the District of Vermont. He announced his resignation 1 week prior to that in a news release issued by his office. In the release, he was praised by Imam Islam Hassan, the faith leader for the Islamic Society of Vermont, and by Rutland Mayor Christopher Louris, who said he appreciated Miller's support for the Syrian refugee program in his city, a process that came to an abrupt halt as a result of President Donald Trump's immigration orders. I had the opportunity to sit down with Eric Miller yesterday and talk about his nearly 2-year tenure as U.S. attorney.
I knew coming into the job, for instance, that the heroin crisis in Vermont would take up an enormous amount of the office's time and energy, and that turned out to be the case. But before I arrived, the office began what it called its heroin initiative, which began and then refined, I think, a really innovative approach to investigating and prosecuting heroin crime in the state of Vermont. We broke the state up into 4 quadrants. We assigned a federal prosecutor to each of those quadrants. And then that federal prosecutor worked really, really closely with state, local, and federal law enforcement in his or her quadrant in order to prioritize the investigations and prosecutions that we thought would be most impactful in Vermont. So I'm extraordinarily proud of the work we did there. I'm also proud of the non-traditional tools that we brought to bear on the heroin crisis, things like the Rutland Federal Drug Court, which was in its infancy when I arrived at the office and which received strong support from us, like the Reentry Court in Vermont, which focuses on bringing people who have been convicted back into society and giving them the skills and often the addiction coping skills that they need to be successful, and using civil forfeiture tools in a judicious way in order to rid communities of drug houses and, at least in one instance, turn them into safe, affordable, owner-occupied housing in a neighborhood in Rutland. So the suite of initiatives that we've taken on with respect to the heroin initiative, I think have been effective, and I'm proud of them. The other thing I'm really proud of is the work our office has done with respect to civil rights in Vermont. When I arrived, we had a very good civil rights program, but I think that we have strengthened and built that in a number of ways. First, both our civil rights coordinator, Colo Karest, and I spent a lot of time reaching out to and improving our relationships with the portions of our community that are most often negatively affected by civil rights violations. But then on top
those
of
being
those being African American community, the New American community, the Muslim American community, among others. And we've spent a lot of time, and I hope successful, really worthwhile time reaching out to those communities, making sure we better understand their concerns and better understand the civil rights violations that are taking place in Vermont so that we can play a positive role in remedying them. In addition to that, we were last year able to add a full-time federal prosecutor who is dedicated to enforcing federal civil rights laws in Vermont. And that's a big deal. We haven't added a prosecutor in 7 or 8 years to this office, but this is a permanent, fully funded position that is dedicated to that part of our mission. In addition, we added a civil rights intake coordinator who should be hired by the office very soon. Together, that group of people, I think, is going to be able to make us, make the office, a real leader in civil rights enforcement in Vermont. I'm really proud of the work that we've done in that area as well.
That civil rights attorney, Julia Torti, who we interviewed on this program, my recollection is that was part of a federal program that was available to all of the states, and many applied and many were able to receive funding for a similar position or the same position in U.S. attorneys' offices around the country. Is that the same for the intake coordinator as well?
It is the same for the intake coordinator. Under President Obama and Attorney General Lynch, money and positions were made available to offices who wanted to energize or re-energize this part of our practice. It was a competitive process. Only a limited number of those positions were handed out to the 93 U.S. attorneys' offices around the country. And in each case, I think we were able to demonstrate a real need for the positions in Vermont, and we were able to put together a case that we were well positioned to really take advantage of what we all know is precious money needs to be allocated to the places it's most impactful.
And that funding you don't think will go away under a Trump administration?
I have no reason to think that that will go away in the future. When we were given the position and the money, it was built into the office's budget and its headcount, and it was provided to us as a permanent position. It's my hope and expectation that both the positions and the work that they do will continue.
But there's no guarantee.
You know, there's never any guarantee. As you know, the federal government is dealing with a hiring freeze right now, for instance. And every part of government understands, this is true at state, federal, and local levels, that they're going to be expected to do more with less. The Department of Justice is no different. But again, I have no reason to believe that that will change. And I know that the people who remain in the office, which is everybody but me, it's only the U.S. attorney who switches with a presidential administration. Everybody there feels that this is a really important part of the office's mission that benefits not just the civil rights work of the office, but also benefits the criminal enforcement work of the office by building positive relationships with all corners of the community.
Eric, if there is something that could be said to be your catchphrase, I guess it would be, we're not the Department of Prosecution, we're the Department of Justice. And you have always highlighted the role that you and that the office plays in this idea of justice. And you were just talking about drug court and reentry court and restorative justice and ways of trying to make society whole rather than just prosecute people for crimes. How did that become so infused in your work as a lawyer?
Well, you know, first, it's always been an important part of the work that the U.S. Attorney's Office in Vermont has done. My predecessors, I think, have equally emphasized that through the work that they have supported in the office. But I think it's also true for many of us who become lawyers. We become lawyers because we view the law as an effective tool to make life better in a bunch of different ways. And one of the reasons I was so excited about taking this job 2 years ago when Senator Leahy recommended me to President Obama for it was because I saw the U.S. Attorney's Office as sitting at the intersection of so many really difficult and important issues, and it could touch upon many of them in different ways. You know, obviously the heroin epidemic, as we've discussed, was top of that list. Human trafficking is on that list. Civil rights, which we've discussed, is on that list. The environment, poverty, so many things that we affect, some in ways more direct than others, but we have the ability to contribute positively on so many fronts. I can't think of an office that is doing more for Vermont than the U.S. Attorney's Office, and that's because all of the really amazing men and women who work there, I think, hold this idea of serving justice above all else really at the forefront of their thoughts as they do their work.
So then why leave? I mean, I know you serve at the pleasure of the president, and we have a new president, but at least to my knowledge, he hadn't forced you out. He hadn't fired you. He hadn't named a replacement. So if all of that work is so valuable and so valuable to you, why resign?
So that's a good question, and let me put it in context. As you pointed out, the U.S. attorneys are appointed by the president, and they serve at his pleasure. It is customary when there is a new president, and particularly when there is a new president from a different party, that the incumbent U.S. attorneys will tender their resignations sometime around inauguration. Some leave a little before, some leave a little after, some agree to remain on for a short period of time while their successors are nominated and confirmed. The day after the election, I walked around our office and sat in each of the offices there and told my folks that I would in all likelihood leave sometime around inauguration. And that's exactly what I did. So, by the way, did most of my colleagues. Fewer than half of President Obama's appointed U.S. attorneys remain in office at this point. And so, you know, in my view, it is very important that the U.S. attorney be comfortable advocating honestly, forcefully, and effectively for the priorities of the president and the attorney general that he or she serves. I was able to do that under President Obama, and I was really proud to advocate for his priorities and those of Attorney General Lynch. But with the inauguration of a new president who I think we would all agree has articulated a very different set of priorities, I decided it was time for me to move on.
You know, you phrase it like a lawyer that and you point out that many of your peers in other places have also resigned. But I don't know about their resignations. Yours certainly made a ripple in Vermont media and among people who watch these things. And I think that's probably in no small part because of the statement that you released when you tendered your resignation. You mentioned Sally Yates, who was fired by Donald Trump. You talked about people who you see as allies in Vermont. And it was not exactly explicit, but it was fairly implied that you don't agree with the policies of Donald Trump. And it was, at least in the writing of it, seemed to be not a protest, that's not quite the right word, but a very strongly worded, careful rebuke of the president.
You know, in the statement that I released announcing my resignation, I did what I think most U.S. attorneys do, which is highlight the work of the office during my tenure that I'm most proud of. So I highlighted our work on heroin. I highlighted our work on human trafficking. I highlighted our civil rights work. And I highlighted in particular the relationships that we've built with communities most negatively affected by civil rights violations, including Vermont's Muslim community. And if those priorities appear to the reader as being in conflict with those articulated by the new administration, I don't think that should come as any surprise, right? The U.S. attorney, as I said, should build his or her work around the priorities of the president and the attorney general he serves. And we have a new president who has articulated very different priorities than President Obama, who appointed me. I and my Obama-appointed colleagues felt strongly, as did our bosses, that we make our country more safe and more just by building trusting relationships with all corners of the community that we serve. And so the accomplishments of the office that I highlighted in my resignation statement were precisely those. I'm proud of them, and I'm going to remain proud of them.
You couldn't work for a President Trump?
The greatest joy of this job over the better part of the last 2 years has been to support the great work of the office and to go out and advocate honestly for positions and initiatives that I believe make life better for Vermonters and which I very, very strongly believe in. I could do that under the Obama administration. In fact, I was proud to do that under the Obama administration. But every president and attorney general are entitled to U.S. attorneys who share at least their fundamental views of the role of the office. And that's why it was time for me to leave.
As you mentioned, the U.S. attorney is the position that is appointed by the president and that is a political appointee. Other people who work in that office are career attorneys, and you know their field is law. They're not really involved in politics except that they work for the U.S. attorney's office. The U.S. attorney can in some ways give political cover or create this barrier between the policies of an administration and the work that the office is doing. And I'm curious if you have any concerns about who might be appointed to your position now and how that might influence the work of these people who worked for you up until last Friday.
First, you're exactly right to say that the real work of the office is done by career civil servants, lawyers and non-lawyers, who investigate cases, they prosecute cases, and the office has always and will always carry out that work without regard to politics. It is nonetheless true that the U.S. attorney provides energy and direction behind certain initiatives. We've talked today about some of those that were important to me and those that I've poured energy into. And as a result, whoever is lucky enough to be the next presidentially appointed U.S. attorney for Vermont will have some choices to make about what he or she believes are the most important initiatives for the office. It's my hope that the work that we've done has proven its worth and has proven effective and has created expectations in constituents outside the office that they now expect our office to be a leader on civil rights. They expect our office to be a leader on heroin, and that together those pressures, in the best sense of the word, will cause the most important of the work to continue with real energy and purpose.
Given what you've articulated as your proudest accomplishments and your priorities, where do you go from here? I know you don't have a plan yet. I know you don't have something that you are officially going to. But in your head, when you think about the next step or the next adventure for you, What's in play?
Well, that's a good question. You know, this is the first time in 30 years that I've left a job or a school without knowing what comes next. And there is great freedom in that. And I'm doing my best to embrace that right now and to explore whatever wonderful possibilities Vermont has to offer. Whatever I end up doing, it's my hope that either through that job or through time that I spend away from that job, that I'll continue to be able to help others advance some of the same priorities that we've discussed today, because they have become personally really important to me during my time in the U.S. Attorney's Office. As I said, I know that many of them are going to continue to receive enormous support and energy from the next U.S. attorney and from the career staff there. But I'm going to do what I can to, you know, help those, whether they're in the public sector or the private sector, to continue to make progress on some of these problems if they're willing to have my help.
Have you had offers already?
No.
I don't believe that.
You know, I made a very concerted decision not to begin looking for a new job until I left my last one. And there are a lot of good reasons to do that. First, to make sure you're focused on the task at hand. Second, to make sure you avoid any conflicts of interest. I have now been out of the U.S. Attorney's Office for exactly 2.5 working days. And as a result, I have not yet gotten very far in the job search.
Well, Eric Miller, good luck in whatever adventure comes next. And thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Coming up next, a chat with Moses Pendleton. He grew up on a farm in Lindenville and went on to become a world-renowned dancer and choreographer. Now he's back in Vermont for a tour with his acclaimed company, Momix. We'll hear from him on dance, aging, shopping for a new brain, and what people and cows have in common. Get ready. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Let me let you in on a little not-so-secret. I like to be in control. It's part of the job of hosting an interview show. I mean, sure, sometimes the conversation leads in unplanned directions, but my hand is still on the steering wheel. But you know how when your car starts to skid on an icy road, you have to turn into the skid? It's counterintuitive, but you just have to go with it if you want to come out alive. Well, that's kind of what you have to do when you interview Moses Pendleton. You realize you cannot control the conversation, so you might as well let go and enjoy the ride. Pendleton grew up on a dairy farm in the Northeast Kingdom, and at Dartmouth College, he turned to dance. He became a world-renowned dancer and choreographer. He even choreographed parts of the Olympic ceremonies in the 1980 Lake Placid Games and the Sochi Games in 2014. This week, his dance company, Momix, is performing in 3 locations in Vermont. 2 performances at the Flynn earlier this week in Burlington, and 2 yet to go in Rutland and Lindenville. So yesterday, I called him up at his hotel room in Stowe to talk about his influences. But, well, as I mentioned, sometimes you have to let go of the steering wheel. You'll see.
Are we going, by the way?
Well, I've started the tape, but we haven't officially started the interview.
Burn some tape, because you never know
when
you're going to be attacked by an idea. And
that's true.
Some sparks will happen when you weren't even, as John Lennon was saying, when you're busy thinking of other things, things happen, or something like that. It's a bad paraphrase.
But no, they always tell
you. But I wanted to say about the storm.
Yeah.
I wanted to not forget to say this, because being a Vermonter and being back in Vermont with our show Momix at the Flynn Theater, I was certain that we needed to cancel the show, that no one would show up. And I was certain of it, and because we were out there, you know, staggering around in the blizzard. And what moved me nearly to tears was to see in the lobby groups of people dumping their SUVs and making their way to the Flynn on cross-country skis, and said they would not be denied Momix. And I felt very proud of to be a Vermonter. You know, they said, "Hey, Moses, just snow."
Yes.
But I loved in the lobby of the Flynn, which you know, I think, mm-hmm. just lined up were like a dozen cross-country skis. They were very enthusiastic, and the show went well, and I was amazed at the turnout. And so I just wanted to add that or put that in and sing the praises of the Vermont spirit. And everyone was very happy. Everyone was telling me, you know, that the snow, you see, It's all about the snow in the winter.
Yeah.
Vermont is snow in the winter. We need the snow. It lightens us. It makes light do interesting things. It makes the ski areas happy, and it softens all the sharp noises in the urban centers. And there's a softening and almost a holiday spirit when that's going on, as long as you're on skis and walking, I guess. But I've never been detailing or determined or, what should I say, concerned with the weather since I was a farm boy, worried about hay getting wet up in northern Vermont.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because, you mentioned the snow and Vermonters, and that must be so familiar to you as somebody who grew up on a farm in the Northeast Kingdom, and I'm curious.
Yeah, but the farmers, you see, also had lived and died over the weather report.
Well, sure.
I've been doing that in my own way, just to get the company around Vermont. But you were saying, sorry.
Well, I mean, that's curious because that's sort of what I'm interested in hearing from you, how your upbringing has shaped your mind and your choreography. And here you are so far away in some ways from the life of a farm boy, and yet the weather is still shaping your life.
The weather is connected with nature and the greater forces beyond the human. You know, I've always been curious about that. I'm very happy to have been brought up in a rural environment where there was air and snow and water and sunlight and all of that, those elements do nurture as nature does to me, and it always has. So there's there's kind of a farmer attitude and an athletic attitude continuing on, and the work that I do and that I work with other people on is dealing with the natural world and how the human can relate to the non-human, the plant and the animal and the mineral, the Holstein Friesian comes to mind. We're a bit Holstein if you dig deep into the world. And I've always been kind of looking at things that you can't see in the common, in the everyday. And in Vermont was very inspirational for me. One thing was not just the farming, of course, and all that connection with weather and the elements and being outside, but also being a skier and a cross-country skier. And I was determined on this time around, as I'm coming to do in the process of this homecoming celebration, was to get up here to the Trapp Family Lodge and get out onto their 65 miles of groomed cross-country trails, which I've been doing for 3 days. And I must tell you, when I get my engines going out there, and my technique is kind of probably hasn't been seen in 30 years, but and it's not much of a technique, but it does get me up and around fairly well. It's coming back to me. So huffing and puffing the other day, going up the hill, I was beginning to hallucinate or remember myself as a cross-country skier way before dance. And it was the sound of the pole in the snow and the sliding of the ski and my quick fatigue that reminded me that I had to just go deeper to get up that hill. I was running the Vermont State champion cross-country race, which I won in 67 at the Putney School. And it all came back to me. So I love exploring memory, and one way to tweak the memory is actually go up and have a reunion with your past cross-country ski self.
Mm-hmm.
and that reunion just, I have just had flashes of another time in my life by going out and getting on those skis and pushing myself. So that's been my experience here, and it's been quite extraordinary.
You were a farmer before you were a skier, and you were a skier before you were a dancer.
Yes.
And you were a dancer before you were a choreographer, and you no
and
longer
I was probably a frog before I was a choreographer. Keep going back, I think. Yes, when I was very young, when I was maybe 12 or 13, my father had passed away, and so the farm kind of shut down. My mother sent me out to be a ski racer. That's how I got into skiing, more seriously. But the Austrian coaches, they're the ones that would tell you to go a little faster downhill, you know, kind of conquer your fear, your physical fear. No fear, I used to scream out all the time.
Really?
No fear. And I apply those same notions to, you know, whatever I did back then and what I experienced. And I kind of continue on with my own company, telling people that, you know, to be free and loose and without fear, as a kind of a philosophy of living and a philosophy of living a very creative and hopefully, you know, a useful life.
How does that apply to aging? Because, you know, as your physical body changes and physicality has clearly been so important to your life,
well, I wonder about aging. Yes, you cannot, we cannot stop the aging. We can only hope to slow it down with discipline. If you look at Tom Brady, almost at 40, remarkable what he's doing in terms of his physical accomplishments and his mental awareness. But he attributes it to great discipline. You know, this is what we need. We need the body doesn't. I don't know what the mind is without the body. So it takes a kind of a Greek ideal of mind and body. So that you got to take care of it. You know, it's your church. It's your temple. It's something to celebrate and enjoy, and you know, and keep the senses alive. And maybe through some kind of art, you can open your eyes or have your eyes opened. And that's it's been something I've been doing, but it's based on physical, like a physical education that I'm so thankful to have. And obviously, there's a connection between, you know, athleticism, skiing, and sports, and dance. You know, I've always often said that we tried to put an aesthetic on the athletic, but the body is there to celebrate and to revel in and to play with and to have fun with. And I've always done that. We used to train just by dancing and playing and improvising and try to make training more fun, more like child's play. And it can be an energizer and you get in shape. Talk about going back to when you're just very young and open-minded and open-eyed and willing and free and without fear.
As you approach 70, though, are there things that your body can't do now? And does that limitation open up anything else?
It does. You know, I've learned to, like, shuffle along at a good pace because I can't bend my knees and that kind of thing. Sure. there's stiffness in the body, you know, in the morning. I have to take a very hot shower upstairs so that I don't break my legs going down the stairs. I have to loosen up. Kind of like you have to loosen up before you do downhill. I have to loosen up before I walk downstairs. And of course, as you get older, you know, the circle kind of tightens. The noose is tightening. You know, the pressure is on. I used to think that I could go out and, you know, run, you know, 10 miles a night. Now I might bike three. And then now if I can't do that because I have a bursitis in my hip, then I'll, you know, maybe just walk around the house, as the doctor said, maybe take 10 laps around the kitchen table. That was very good, Mo. That's very good. Let's see if you can do 11. And the only future I see ultimately is maybe you can't do anything and you just stay in your bedroom and you move on into some other place as you hand back your body or whatever's left of it. But in the meantime, as I say, you can't stop the process of life, which includes death. But you can have an attitude towards it that doesn't make it so fearful and makes the moment more meaningful, because that's all it is really. And if you're adaptable, if you go take almost a Tai Chi approach to living and how your body is changing, but it's still you can find and invent ways, you know, to keep your days, but you know, fairly much in a positive mode. That's a challenge.
Yes, no kidding.
Right.
Challenge for all of us.
Yes. Well, as I say, I've heard that if every year you live after 70, you have a chance to live 5 more years because of all the advancements in technology and science and medicine that could actually help all those parts that seem to be running out or in need of replacement. And, you know, they can do full hip replacements, knee, arm, bones, kidneys, heart. You know, the next thing to replace is the brain, and they're working on that. But
would you want a brain replacement?
I certainly do. Yeah.
You do?
Wouldn't you like to be somebody else, a little smarter and a little wittier?
Sure, but how do you know? You might get somebody you hate who's suddenly inhabiting your head.
I think you have to shop around and see what's available.
You could try them on, you think, before you...
You can wear a brain for about a week and still get your money back if you're not happy with the new you.
As long as you don't wear it outside and wear it out.
Right. Yeah, that's right. You need the skull. It comes with. That's extra.
That's right. What do you... it's so fascinating to talk with you because, it's like keeping up with a ski racer, except, I feel like I'm in snowshoes and you're on gliding skis.
Yes,
I'm running to keep up.
Well, I went to the base of Mansfield, Spruce Peak, on a beautiful sunny day yesterday and just had a lunch and a glass of Chardonnay and looked through the window at the skiers, and I got kind of vicariously some downhill in.
You paint a lovely picture. It sounds like a nice way to spend a few days.
It is.
Moses, before I have to relinquish the studio.
Oh, no. We're just getting warmed up.
I know. Tell me about it. I'm curious because, I've read a lot of interviews with you and things about you, and you've said about Momix, we're less of a dance company than a physical visual theater. And I, for Vermont audiences who know you and know your work, I'm curious about, what it in your heart you hope that audiences are experiencing when they watch Momix.
Yes. Well, in the word mix, it's not just dance, but there's dance in it. It's not acrobatics. There are acrobatic movements. We use, they're not gymnasts, but they're something that looks a little bit like Cirque du Soleil, perhaps. We use props, lights, special music to create, an atmosphere and an environment that hopefully an audience will be engaged not fall asleep by the experience of it. And we don't really tell stories, but I think that there is a series of images that may spark the imagination and create some impressions in the individual. And I think there's a lot for people to see on many levels. The body is also just a fascinating thing. These are highly trained physical, musical specimens out there. They're worth looking at just when they're standing around out there. quite marvelous. A nice herd to gaze at. That's kind of what it is. Mm-hmm. There's through imagery, nonverbal imagery, that there's... people can put and try to see things that may not be the same thing another person next to them is seeing, which is fine. But we try to be evocative, I guess I'm saying. We're not trying to tell people what they should see. We're just offering a chance for them to escape from the reality into the fantasy world of Momix. And of course, for me, always the fantasy is an integral part of reality. It's a dream state that hopefully is not a nightmare.
Well, I missed the Flynn performances.
Oh, you did?
Yes, but I have several friends who went who were just transfixed. They said it was absolutely beautiful.
Well, the audience was on its feet and in a real authentic way, and I was quite inspired. I actually saw new things in the piece. I usually go in the back and I videotape and I complain about one little thing or another that no one sees. But I turned on the camera and just went right down in the middle of the house, in the middle of that Vermont audience, and really enjoyed the show. And it's a show that we did 18 years ago. But I love to see how it was resonating, not just with the audience, but with me. I was very inspired by my own work and my work in collaboration with others. But I was... I was revved up by it, and I'm ready to. I always tell the dancers this was a great show. It's a great piece. Therefore, it's worthy of further rehearsal, just like any good coach.
Well, I hope both of the performances that remain go as wonderfully as the first two did, and I really appreciate you speaking with us and telling me a little bit about your life and mind. It's been so wonderful, Moses. Thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
If you're like me and you missed Momix at the Flynn, you can still see the company tonight at the Paramount Center in Rutland or tomorrow at the Linden Institute Alumni Hall in Lindenville. And we got this note from Paul who says Momix was scheduled to perform two student matinees at the Flynn Theater on Monday of this week, but snow canceled all schools on Monday. Momix was kind enough to jigger their travel plans and perform their student matinees on Tuesday instead. Countless students benefited from their generosity. Very classy. And that's our show for today. Some key issues at the State House right now are developing a new primary health care plan, how the president's immigration policies could affect the state's dairy industry, and raising the minimum wage. Tomorrow on this program, we'll hear the thoughts of Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman on these and other issues. You can send your questions for him to vermontedition@vpr.net and then listen live tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone. Jake Rusnak directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.